Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. As summer approaches, many nonprofit and faith leaders in Boston will turn their attention to youth, keeping youth busy, employing them, reducing community violence. But a small number of local nonprofits place heavy attention on our most at-risk city youth, for example, those most actively engaged in gangs, year-round. And Boston Uncornered is one of them. Here's their CEO, Mark Culleton, on Radio Boston. It's a full 3 years ago now, before the pandemic, talking about what their kids need most.
If you can get gang-involved young people to have a little bit of trust, have a little bit of ability to show vulnerability, to ask for help, they can do anything. And that's the heart of the problem.
So 3 years later, Boston Uncornered has gone all in on mental health supports that encourage their youth to show some vulnerability, ask for help, and put themselves on their path to a pro-social life and to college. And after the pandemic, the organization knows they need to take care of the mental health needs of their staff, too. Eleanor Forbes is Boston Uncornered's first director of mental health, and Ruben De Silva is a former Boston Uncornered student who now works as a college readiness advisor. Both are here in Studio 2. Eleanor, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And Ruben, welcome to you, too.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So, Eleanor, I'm going to start with you. Remind folks what Boston Uncornered does and who you focus on.
So Boston Uncornered really focuses on bringing young people from the corner to the educational field, giving them the opportunity to finish their high school essential academics through obtaining their GED, or as we call it now, their HISET, and then go on to college if that's so they desire. And the majority of them do choose to go that pathway for opportunity they never thought that they would have before. So what do I do? I provide the mental health services for our staff, as we know that, you know, all of our staff comes from a trauma background, gang involvement, drugs. And at this point, I get to have them work on their mental health as they continue to provide mental health supports for the young people actually coming in.
So, Ruben, how would you describe your work now that you work at Boston Uncornered?
I would say it's an eye-opener because there's a lot of things that I didn't open myself to before. And seeing the work that the CRA is doing, the resources that we have and provide to the people that's on this background, I see how, like, it can empower them to make their own decisions and take control of their own life and choose to be, like, a productive member of society and go forward.
And when you engage with a young person, Ruben, as a college readiness advisor, for you, like, yeah, I know the organization, but for you, what's your goal?
May I try to keep it real with them? Because I know one thing that, you know, I say the streets, one thing I know they respect is realness, and, you know, and You just, like, you know, going in there with anything else, oh, you know, this for college, do it for yourself, it's not going to really appease to them where you could just be real with them. Like, what can we do now so we could get the other goals in the future, like, attainable?
That sounds like you have to be a little bit vulnerable, a little bit transparent.
Of course. You're dealing with people that's been through a lot of trauma in their life from all different type of background, like, and some of the stuff you wouldn't even imagine. And talking to them, suspecting them to even, you know, care about themselves, focus on themselves when sometimes, most of the time, they're so lost. You got to bring yourself to their level. You know, if you've been in their shoes, you got to humble yourself and really just, you know, open your heart and let them be honest with you.
And is that hard?
I would say before, but right now I'm getting the skills that, like, I had the skills, but not for this type of work. And right now I see, like, I'm developing it where I could say that, okay, I'm comfortable doing this because, you know, if I'm not, I could relay the wrong message. I could push someone away. So if it's hard, yeah. Is it going to stay hard? Does it have to be hard? Of course not.
So Eleanor, I'll turn back to you here because, Ruben, what I feel like part of what you're telling us is that you have to model for the young people the way you want them to be. Authenticity, a little bit of vulnerability. We heard Mark talk about that and that cut at the top. So, Eleanor, how are you helping? I want to ask you how you're helping the team at Boston Uncornered do that, but I also feel like that's almost jumping ahead because I'm guessing that we don't imagine how hard it is to do that work in the first place.
Right. I'm going to say it's really hard because you have to, as I always tell the staff at Uncornered, I live by Carl Rogers' unconditional positive regard. You have to first be able to be in a place to accept it yourself first. You have to know that you come from a background of trauma. We all have some type of traumatic experience that happened in our life, whether it's family, whether we've been involved in something ourselves. And once we be able to accept that and then become vulnerable and open to share that with others, whether it's our family or whether we seek some professional help, that's the beginning road to where we're going. And when I came into Uncornered, I had to make sure that I developed these relationships that allow people to be open and vulnerable with me. And you have to come into that, as Ruben stated previously, just open and honest. You know, people can always read disingenuous, you know, behavior or attributes, you know, a mile away. So when you come in with that type of personality and warm and acceptance, it allows people to open up and be comfortable. And I believe that I allowed the Uncornered team to see that in me and allowed them to be open. And with that, I would say like 60% of our staff, almost 70% is all now seeking mental health services on their own, where before we were at like maybe 2% when I came on board. And again, as long as you're open to say that I want to do some work and see that happiness is a place that you can get to and something that could be inside you every day. That's a beautiful feeling. And I, you know, I'm always grateful that the Uncornered staff, you know, trust me to do that. Trust me to, as I say, I'm a walk-in diary that's locked for the world to, you know, don't have access to. And by them being open to trust me to do that, that's a wonderful thing.
Ruben, you did a lot of nodding while Eleanor was talking just there. So let me just turn back to you and let you comment.
I could testify to everything she's saying. Like, you know, me and Eleanor, we have our own little side story because I'm pretty sure you have one with every staff, but everyone probably say the same thing. Mine feels just personal instead of like just talking to any type of mental health clinician, you know, which, you know, I've been through, incarcerated from the inside and the outside. That relationship is important.
What's different? Why does it feel comfortable and do you embrace it now?
The thing that really feels different is just the relating part. And I'm still trying to like put a word to it. Like I could say she gives me like, you know, family vibes. Sometimes she gives me mother vibes, sister vibes. But when you break it down, it's like she makes me feel comfortable, no pressure, and lets me be open, like patience with the time. If I don't want to, I could, while I'm talking to her, I could sense it. Like there's something I wouldn't want to go into. It would probably go into a conversation where she could relate to from like her walk of life, and, you know, the conversation would stay that instead of like, oh, well, tell me about yourself. What did you do? Did this happen to you? Maybe I'm not, like, ready to open up right now. But hearing it, like, you know, her kind of relating it to someone she knows that you could say been in the same shoes as me, of course I'm going to listen. Of course I'm going to try to relate it to me. And it's going to open a door for the future to have that full in-depth conversation.
So, Eleanor, what would you be comfortable sharing about your own lived experience that you think allows you to engage? And I see that you're feeling emotional. I want to be respectful of that.
Yeah, it's emotional when you hear people talk about you, things that you don't normally think about. But I'm a child that came from trauma, physical abuse, mom addicted to substances, absent father. And a lot of the lived experiences from the gun violence, street violence that we deal with, I know that coming in this mental health field, I had to do some work on me first in order to give back. As they say, sometimes hurt people, or sometimes hurt people, help people. but I know in helping people, I needed to help me first. And with this population, most clinicians and therapists do not want to work with this population because they feel unsafe. They feel like they're going to be harmed, or they can't really deal with the explosiveness of the anger and the impulsive behavior that sometimes can come from ex-gang members or those who have been incarcerated. And I just have this true desire to all people need help. All people need support, and no one should be stigmatized or taken away from that, knowing that we come from poverty and so much other disparities that happens to us. So it touches me because I get to always share my experiences of what I've been through in order to help encourage them to be open. Sometimes I know when we're taught academics, they say, you know, don't self-disclose. And the one thing I've learned in this practice is to be open, to be available, to self-disclose when necessary, because it's one of the biggest things that help people, and to really be able to build that relationship with trust.
So then how do you keep yourself whole? Who's carrying you?
So I have two mental health therapists.
Oh, you didn't know that, Ruby.
I didn't know that. She looked like a superhero.
So I always tell my clients and those that I have two, I see a female therapist, so that way it's helping me to develop myself, and also a male, because we can bring a lot of biases to the table, especially when we're dealing with men. And I always want to make sure that I have a clear conscience and being able to understand a male's perspective and not just walking always into a situation with a female perspective. And by doing that, having two therapists to understand these roles, it's been really helpful. And as Ruben said, I think it's been helping these guys out a lot at Uncornered.
Ruben, Eleanor talked about biases there. And earlier in the conversation, you said a lot of the young people you're working with have kinds of trauma we can't imagine. And I don't want to tour someone else's trauma. That's not helpful. But I do want to help people who are listening understand what we don't understand and should about the lived experience of the young people and the young men you were working with. What do we need to know?
I know we watch movies, and I know we like to think we have an idea of how, you know, this person of this background is going to react or how they think, but you'll find out, like, half the time, judging like that, it's not like you're just becoming part of the problem. You know, just leave it alone. Don't judge. Or if you're going to say something, if you're going to help, help. But if you're just going to fit into the stereotypes, you're just going to become part of the problem.
How do you practice non-judgment? What does that look like in your work?
Hypocritical. If I try, come on. I try to, like, one mental health thing that I do, it's called, what's that word? Mindfulness. Mm-hmm. That's, like, a thing that I noticed I did before, but I didn't know, you know, the word, that's the label, and X, Y, and Z. But when you practice mindfulness, like, you're looking at another human being. Think about it. There's no class, there's no status, how much money, how much time you did, who's your father, your mother, were you raised? None of that. We all live in this planet together. And aside from that, like, if I'm going to talk to a student that I know came from my background, I know what to approach, like, especially the vibe, the energy. I know how to approach with, and I know what's immediately going to get me, like, the energy of, like, I'm going to hear you out, but nothing is going through. One ear, out the other. Like, one thing, like, I see on all the CRAs, too. That's probably how they got to me, because when I came to College Bound, it was just, you know, specifically probation, keep it off my back. The realness is, like, the key front. We can't get through no student if you can't keep it real with them in all aspects.
What made you want to move into the role? So first, you're a student at Boston Uncornered. What made you want to do the work yourself?
I think, all right, so there's a lot of things. Like, when I was a student, before it was even a student intern, like, working with the CRAs, knowing that...
College Readiness Advisors, just so our listeners know. Sorry, go ahead.
Of course. Even I have to get into the habit of remembering. I just say the CRA sometimes. But knowing, like, just watching them. They came, some of them, if not like, you know, there's no comparing, but some of them came from trauma. Some of them came from like a background I could have been in. And you could see like they're blessed because of course they're here, they're talking to me as a student. Seeing like them do their work and me just like, because I have a passion for like, you know, governments, economics, corruption, stuff like that. Just talking about it, still feeling like powerless. I think they've seen like, oh, this is one way right now through us. You could gain some power over this. You know, you could help the next man. The kid that made the mistake at 16, he's out there 13 years old before he made that mistake. Maybe I could get through him right there and then. And me just staying quiet, walking by and not saying nothing, still feeling like I should do something. You know, that I could say that that really pushed me into wanting to help out with this work. I wasn't really looking for a job, but it got to one day when I wrote on the CEO's board that, like, listen, Mark, we need to have a talk. I didn't think he was going to hear me out. The man is busy. Like, he's out here talking to, like, I remember I did an event with a technical, one of the Boston's high technical business, like, excuse me for not knowing the name.
That's all right.
But that was my first time speaking to, you know, a crowd of people, a crowd of, like, I don't want to use the word, like, you know, civilians, yeah. Stuff like that. Just right. Speaking to a crowd of business.
Influential people.
Yeah. And I got heard. And, you know, I studied everybody who was there with me. And I seen the work firsthand, what it could do. And I was still a student, just speaking about my walk and, like, what happened when I came from jail, how I got into college bound. And then seeing them, like, you know, hearing me out, wanting to invest. And then I could go back to that student and be like, yo, come in with us, man. Like, it feels good.
And do you feel like you have some power now?
Here's the thing about knowledge. I do. But I found out there's still a lot more work to do. Because, you know, now that I'm in, I'm part of the Career Readiness Advisors and seeing their work, seeing the upper board, what they're doing. I know this mission is not a year thing. It's not a, you know, maybe not a 5-year thing. It's a whole country thing. It's a every borough, every, these words that they use, urban, hood, this is out there. And I moved around a lot. I'm not from this country. It's the same story everywhere. It's just different faces. Same story everywhere.
Eleanor, with that ringing in our ears, what's the work for you in the next year or so?
My work is to continue to do what I'm doing. I agree with Ruben. It's the same thing, everything, everywhere. So I think that we should just continue to take one student at a time, you know, one community at a time, and continue to build because this is what we need. And I think that we don't need to stop keeping mental health first. It's really, really important. And we need to, I'm always reminded of Beyonce's song, Listen. We just need to take the time to listen to the young people who are talking. And we just need to continue to encourage them to be able to speak and know that we're not giving them a voice. We need to stop and listen to allow them to be vulnerable, to speak up, and then to be able to have the resources there to help guide them. And I think that that's where we start.
All right. And that is Eleanor Forbes, Boston Uncornered's first director of mental health, and Ruben Da Silva, a former Boston Uncornered student who's now a college readiness advisor. Great to meet you. Thank you both for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Giving us
Thank
a voice.
You. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's going to get rough. That is the de facto headline of a new climate report by UMass Boston. The average annual temperature in Boston could rise between 3 and 10 degrees Fahrenheit in the next 80 years, and the number of days over 90 degrees per year could double. So here to give us the big takeaways from the report, WBUR's environmental correspondent, Barbara Moran. Welcome back, Barbara.
Hi, Tiziana.
Great to have you here. So it's going to get bad, huh?
Yes. So this is interesting. This is a follow-up report from UMass that they did for the city of Boston in 2016. And this year, they expanded it out to cover the greater Boston area. And here's the top line takeaways. Boston, as we all could tell already, it's getting hotter and wetter. This report was actually able to put some numbers on it. It looks like sea level rise is going to go up 4.8 feet by 2100. That's actually a downward estimate from the last report, which is a little bit of good news, I suppose. But it does mean that nuisance flooding is going to increase. And that's sort of those sunny day floodings that you see on Morrissey Boulevard a lot or in, you know, like down on the wharf. And right now we get about 10 days like that a year. And that could be up to half the days every year by 2050.
That's just incredible.
Yeah, I couldn't even believe it. I had to ask the scientists, like, again, like, for real, half the days? I mean, it's just going to change things, right? So heat is the thing we understand the best, or the scientists understand the best. Right now, we get about 8 to 9 days in the greater Boston area that go over 90 degrees. By 2050, we're going to have like 25 to 30 days, so like a month days over 90. And that's kind of baked in. That's not like an if. That's actually what we're looking at is going to happen.
No matter what.
No matter what, yeah. Even if we stopped using fossil fuels today, we're still looking at a month-ish of days over 90.
So basically triple what we've been experiencing,
yes,
is baked in.
Baked in.
No pun intended.
Yes.
And then, but it could be worse, right?
Right. And then it sort of, you know, diverges depending on what we do with fossil fuels. And by the end of the century, we're looking at about 2 months over 90. And that's the likely scenario, I hate to say. And it could get up to 80 days or more over 90, which, again, is so unbelievable that I actually called the professor last night to double check, because I'm like, this is like so bad, it can't even be true. But yes, that's what we're looking at.
So let's stay there for a second, because you talked to the professor. I know you brought us some sound of the professor, who you should name, telling us how, whether or not we're built to be that hot here.
That's right. So Ellen Douglas was one of the lead co-authors on this report. She's an environmental professor at UMass Boston. And I was asking her, you know, like, what's going to happen in Boston? And that's what she said. She talked about a bunch of different things. But the key thing is that Boston is not built for this kind of weather. And here's what she said.
When you have 3 or 4 or 5 days of temperatures over 90 or 95, the buildings are absorbing heat. The pavement is absorbing heat, and it's not cooling down at night, so that heat isn't getting released. So it's just building and building and building, and it begins to exceed the capacity of our cooling systems.
So when I was talking to her, I'm like, well, you know, I mean, people live in Texas and Alabama, and they, like, deal with it, right? So
exactly.
What's the big deal? And she's like, well, you know, it's like she said, Boston is designed for it. Like, the asphalt we use here is different. You know, the bridges are designed to a certain capacity. Train rails are designed to deal with a certain heat. And none of that infrastructure is ready for this heat that's going to be coming.
For 80 days of 90 degrees.
Exactly.
So I'm going to pause there, and I'm just going to flag that you're going to come back tomorrow, and we're actually going to have Sanjay Seth, who is the City of Boston's Climate Resilience Program Manager, on tomorrow, literally to talk about how Boston and other cities and towns are going to have to retool to respond to this report.
Exactly.
For now, though, other implications that we might not be thinking about, but that you're thinking about, because this is, you know, what you follow, that you want on people's minds.
Well, I'm thinking a lot, you know, because summer is coming up, and I think a lot about, you know, safety of people and, like, vulnerable people, but just people who, like, work outside. Like, I'm thinking that, you know, we're going to have to develop protections for outdoor workers or construction workers. And I'm also thinking a lot about sports, like sport camps, you know, or, like, high school sports that start training, yeah, like, in August, right? And I want to make sure that if my kids are going to start, you know, having practice in August, that the coaches have a plan for dealing with this heat, and they're not out in the middle of the day, you know, keeling over from heat stroke, right? So those aren't, I don't think that's stuff that's front of people's mind here in Boston.
And yet so practical. All right, so we're going to bring you back tomorrow to talk more about what we can do. Thanks for those headlines. That's Barbara Moran, WBUR environmental correspondent. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Okay, so we do have sun and heat on our mind. And we are ready for our regular segment, Be Well. So in order to help us be well in the sun and heat, Dr. Jeffrey Dover of Skin Care Physicians is here to help us think about how to stay in the sun, or be in the sun, or not be in the sun, and stay healthy. And we'd love to hear from you. You can tweet us, or if you're in our texting group, send a text. Are you snapping up sunscreen at the store? Do you wear the big brand brimmed hat? Do you know how to keep yourself safe from the sun? Do you have questions? You can tweet us at Radio Boston, or send us a text at 617-766-0382. If you are in our texting group, that's 617-766-0382. Dr. Dover, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, can we be in the sun or not?
The quick answer is absolutely, and we have no choice. So we just have to be thoughtful about it. And so Mad Dogs and Englishmen Go Out in the Midday Sun, a famous quote from Broadway. And we know the best thing to do is to try to avoid the sun or limit sun. So shady side of the street, an umbrella, a tree. Luckily, Boston is a very green city and the suburbs are very green. But if you're out on a soccer pitch, as we just heard, or playing football in August on the gridiron, not the safest place to be. So early in the morning, late in the afternoon, before 10 and after 3, much better and much safer. The beach early or late, a big umbrella under a tree, a big, big hat, as you mentioned, that's comfortable but looks nice so your friends don't think you're going to a Mexican fiesta, but you're actually dressed casually and attractively, and sunscreen. But I think if we do it thoughtfully, there's a way to do it because we don't have a choice.
So that is if you do have a choice to some extent, right? Well, and I'm thinking back to Barbara Moran still resonating in my ears there. There are many outdoor workers in the summer who will be outside for lots of different reasons, whether you're a construction worker, or you're in landscaping, or you're a lifeguard, or maybe you're a parks and recreation tour guide. There could be any of a number of things. So if you do have to be out in the sun for extended periods of time, the top three things that are most protective?
So the best are, you look at people who work in construction, for example. These are smart men and women. You notice they start at 6 in the morning and they cut off around 2 or 3 at the latest. They actually work the cooler part of the day. You notice they often wear drapery over their necks. They often wear long sleeves and they don't wear shorts. They wear protective clothing and they drink lots of water.
So sunscreen's not enough.
So sunscreen loses out every time. The sun always wins. It's the best thing to think about. So protective clothing and a hat and shade wins every time, but the sun will beat sunscreen every time. Now, we do have nice, great new sunscreens, which are chemical-free physical blockers, which are elegant and thin and not pasty and thick like the old ones. They're brand new just in the last couple of years with titanium or zinc oxide. Highly safe, highly effective. SPF 35s up to 50 or higher. They go on nice and thin, don't feel hot and sticky. Great idea. But if you have a choice, protective clothing like long sleeves or a sun shirt and a hat, much, much better than sunscreen alone.
Light skin is different than dark skin. We have different melanin in our skin depending on our race, our ethnicity. What is the relationship between how much melanin you have in your skin and what level of protection you need?
So the darker your skin, the more protected you are from sun, but you're not totally protected. And it's very well known now that skin cancer occurs in people of all colors, not just very fair-skinned people. Fair-skinned people know they burn more easily, but even the darkest African-American will sunburn in a bright, sunny day. So sunscreen, protective clothing, and just thoughtfulness. For moms especially, teach kids young. If you wait till they're teens, they will never learn to brush their teeth every day and put on sunscreen. So no one would ever go to work or school without brushing their teeth, but a lot of people go out without sunscreen on a cloudy day, but who knows what's going to happen when you leave for lunch or you're out on the playing field and the sun suddenly comes out. So sunscreen every day, reapply if you're at the beach or out in a sunny environment, and pick a sunscreen that you really like, that you like to put on. And that's a habit that people can actually follow.
All right, we've got lots of questions, so I'm going to take some now. One from our texting group is Kate from Malden, who wants to know, does using 30 SPF prevent you from getting the vitamin D that you need?
Great question. It turns out that we get tons of vitamin D in the Boston area. All you need is 15 minutes of just a little bit of sun a day, and you get plenty of vitamin D. If a woman especially who's menstruating is vitamin D deficient, which is so easy to check with a simple blood test at your regular annual checkup, you can take a tiny vitamin D capsule once a day and get all the vitamin D you need. But lying out in the sun or going out in the sun without protective clothing and getting skin cancer and, God forbid, wrinkles, like, it just doesn't make sense. So we're very easy. It's easy to keep your vitamin D level up and to protect your bones and your health.
So you do need some sun, but an average everyday lifestyle should give you sufficient exposure in New England to get you the vitamin D that
Absolutely.
You need. All right. So we've got another question here. This is Danielle in Norwell. I was hoping you could talk about how safe chemical sunscreens really are, which chemicals are worse than others, and how it relates to using it on kids and pregnant and breastfeeding mothers.
Well, it used to be in America that the best sunscreens were the chemical sunscreens. It's been made pretty clear that they're not the best thing in the world, and we actually like organic or safe or natural non-chemical products. So We now don't recommend chemical sunscreens any longer for kids or adults. And for example, today I'm wearing one that's titanium dioxide. You can't see it. You can't feel it. It feels like an elegant cream, not expensive, very thin. So titanium or zinc oxide, not nanoparticle, but just regular titanium or zinc oxide available at CVS or Walgreens, not expensive, easy to apply, and works really well for an SPF 30 up to a 50.
So this has been on my mind because sunscreens can be really expensive. And if we're saying that this is like, you know, wearing clothes, that's a big ticket item over time. You're saying that the affordable sunscreens on the market, we can feel confident, can also be safe and effective.
Absolutely. Consumer Reports and others report on these every year. And the amazing thing is the winners are $5 for a giant bottle available at a regular Walmart, CVS, Walgreens, and easy to apply, not expensive. Hawaiian Tropic keeps winning. Coppertone wins. Aveeno, Johnson & Johnson, Neutrogena. These are all great sunscreens. They're not expensive, even for a family of five, because you don't actually need a lot. They go on easily.
So you just use a little.
You know, we never use enough, but a little is a lot better than none at all. And the cost, frankly, should not be the issue. So if it's $5 or $6 for a big bottle, that'll last a family actually for most of the summer. So really, cost is not the issue. It's really the habit.
All right. So Teddy from Dover wants to know what sunscreen would be best for swimming laps. And how waterproof is waterproof sunscreen?
So, Teddy, it turns out that waterproof sunscreens are not the best thing in the world. So when I swim, which I do regularly, I wear a swim shirt now, which is long sleeve, very thin, clingy, not expensive, looks cool. People want to know where I got it. We now give it as gifts to our friends when they come to visit. So a swim shirt would be better than sunscreen. But if you're out swimming in an outdoor pool and doing laps for an hour, you're going to get an awful lot of sun on your back and your arms. And those sunscreens that are really thick and pasty will work better than the thin ones. They're just not very elegant. So it's a trade-off.
All right. So last question, Jeff from Cambridge, saying that his teenager recently spent 6 hours in the sun at Nahant and with hardly any sunscreen protection. So the question is, quote, this sunburn is, quote, the kind that kids get when their genetic heritage is Northern European, along with hoping this is a learning moment. What can we do to help him heal? End quote.
Unfortunately, once you have a sunburn, it's hard to actually get rid of it except for time. So aspirin and nonsteroidals and Tylenol help with pain, but don't make the sunburn go away faster. A nice moisturizer, cool compresses with a cool wet cloth will help. But unfortunately, once the cat's out of the bag, it's actually almost too late. But it will be a great learning experience because my guess is he won't do this again anytime soon. Sunscreen, but in his case, a hat and a shirt would have been much better than being on the beach without that shirt on.
All right. So that is our Be Well segment for this week. Dr. Jeffrey Dover is of Skin Care Physicians in Brookline. Thanks so much for joining us and answering
our
questions.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
So for the last few weeks, every Wednesday, we have brought you conversations on leadership. We're calling the series Stepping Up, and it's all about talking with folks in the greater Boston region who are making deep change in their communities. Last week, we spoke with Geeta Pradhan, who is a disruptor in the foundation world. She's now president of the Cambridge Community Foundation. We've heard from Reverend Willie Bodrick II, who's senior pastor at the historic 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury, and we kicked it off with Doug Rao, food security pioneer and founder of the nonprofit grocery chain Daily Table. Each conversation is keyed on some moment or decision or approach to leadership as we look to explore what it takes to step up and lead, what it costs those who do it, and what might be preventing some of the next generation of leaders from stepping up, how we can clear that path. So today, we are joined by Jen Fagel, Executive Director of Commonwealth Kitchen, which is a nonprofit that helps support inclusive food entrepreneurship in the city of Boston. It provides things like shared kitchen space, manufacturing to folks who've not traditionally had access to the kinds of tools you need to do that manufacturing, et cetera. Jen, welcome.
Thank you so much, Tiziana.
So one of the reasons we were so interested in talking to you is about the way you got engaged with Commonwealth Kitchen. Mm-hmm. And I want to pick up on that. But let's make sure that my description of Commonwealth Kitchen was sufficient. What else would you need people to know about who the organization is and what it does?
Yeah, so Commonwealth Kitchen at its core is really about how do we break down the barriers for people who want to start food businesses, and particularly looking at women, immigrants, people of color who have been traditionally left out, under-resourced, don't have networks. And so how do we create opportunities? Really, because it's about wealth building, economic opportunity, economic mobility, because we know that if we want to actually close the Boston's growing racial wealth divide, we have to look at assets and wealth. And the best way for people to actually get assets and wealth is home ownership, quality jobs, and small business ownership. So for us, business ownership is key. So we always say, look, food is our passion, but equity is our mission.
And what are the big barriers that people face that you're able to remove as Commonwealth Kitchen?
Yeah, so we started with the fundamental idea that the biggest challenge for anybody is the cost of the kitchen. So could we find a way to lower that barrier? And we came up with what seemed like a very elegant solution, which is a shared kitchen. So think about it as a gym membership for food companies. So instead of renting to go work out on a treadmill, you get to come into our kitchen and use lots of big equipment. But we immediately realized that having a great recipe and access to a kitchen is not enough to build a great business, particularly if you don't have cash, access to networks, and the industry is incredibly insular. And so what we really needed to do was to look at how do we help break down the barriers around permits, license, scaling your recipe, distribution, sales, marketing, pitching, cash flow management. So that led us into a whole range of business education programming that we now provide, but also access to markets. So how do these businesses get recognized and get access, whether it's into a big grocery store? Can we get them onto college campuses, into the dining services, into retail opportunities? And so we really see our work as this kind of vertically integrated model where we work with a business along their journey from the idea of a concept all the way through to an established company.
So very briefly, give us one example.
An example of this would be Jamaica Me Hungry. Some people have heard of this business. Started with a catering company, with a food truck. Came into our kitchen and really needed help on how he could scale to the next level. He needed help with access to capital. How is he going to find it? He needed help accessing markets. And so we actually put him into his own retail space on a pop-up basis in Cambridge that allowed him to build his team, build his systems, build his staff, actually put some cash in his pocket, and that led us to help him actually open his very first restaurant in Jamaica Plain in 2019.
And your favorite food at his restaurant?
Oh my God, everything. The jerk chicken is fantastic.
All right. So now I want to come to you because I've known you for a number of years now, and it has always stuck with me that you didn't actually mean to be the head of Commonwealth Kitchen.
No.
Tell the story.
Absolutely not. So I actually have all of my career is doing real estate development in the nonprofit sector. So I spent 20 years doing affordable housing development, commercial development, all from a mission base. And what I saw and got frustrated was that we were doing really important work to help low-income families be able to stabilize what they were doing by living in all the other affordable housing, but we weren't actually moving them out of poverty. And so I got really interested in what were the tools that were allowing us to build affordable housing, and could we find those same tools to help people actually build wealth? And so the whole idea of Commonwealth Kitchen was, can we essentially de-risk the business to give them the chance to actually try and learn, sometimes fail, hopefully make it? And it's essentially the same thing that they do in affordable housing, where you create things like tax incentives for private investors to invest in affordable housing. So we de-risk the investment in the affordable housing. And so for me, Commonwealth Kitchen was this kind of grand experiment in, could we actually change the reality for families?
So you helped, as I understand it, you helped found it in 2009.
Correct.
But it was in 2014 when you were helping with a real estate transaction that something happened, and the next thing you know, you're actually running it.
Yes, this was never supposed to be my plan. And I was asked to step in 2014 in the middle of a leadership crisis. And there was a need for me to step in and take over on an interim basis. It was right before we were opening the new facility that the organization was just moving into. My job was to do the financing and the vision for the piece of real estate in Dorchester in an old hot dog factory. I had done my job, was moved on to other projects, and then we found out that money had been moved that shouldn't have been moved from the nonprofit. I was asked by the city and others, could I step in on a temporary basis? I said, well, I know nothing about food businesses. I know nothing about small business development. I am an entrepreneur in my own way, and I am somebody who is dogged in my belief in the work that we do, and said, I'll step in temporarily. That temporary has now been, what are we at?
Eight years.
Yeah.
So you didn't have what you need when you started in terms of leadership skills.
I mean, So when I think about leadership, leadership for me is really, it's so much about who we are as people and relationships and emotion and being willing to take risk and have a vision, even if you don't really know the steps to that vision. And that's really my career in doing real estate development, was trying to put together projects that everybody else said, I don't see it. I don't understand how you get from A to Z. And I have always been a person that somehow is able to see all the way through to A to Z and be able to translate that from something that feels chaotic into something that's very linear. And in many ways, that started for me because my original background is actually as a carpenter. And so when you think about
doing— I did not see that coming.
I know. So when you think about working in construction, you have to build a foundation before you can put the walls up. And the walls have to go up for the electrical to go in. And all of those things are very sequential. But you have to be able to see the vision of what you're trying to build in order to put the pieces together. And I feel like that is, if I have a superpower, that is it, which is to be able to see that vision and then understand how do we actually put the pieces together to make that vision real.
So when was the moment you step in 2014? Mm-hmm. You're like, I don't really know this business. I've been doing this other thing. You're asking me to step in here. Mm-hmm. When was the moment when you realized, oh, this is what I do now? This is not temporary. This is the mission I want, and this is what I do now.
I don't think I've hit it yet, honestly. I say to everybody every day, I feel like an imposter. Like, I don't feel like I'm an expert in the food industry, and yet I have become one by hard work. I feel like I spend every day learning because it is a world that I don't know. I don't know the food industry. I don't know food businesses. And so
How can you not after 8 years?
Because it doesn't feel that way, right? So this is also the reality for lots of people who are leaders, and certainly as women, right? That's part of it, is we feel like, how could I possibly be the person that
imposter
knows this?
Imposter syndrome, yeah.
Of course. I also think, though, that helps me to be better, honestly, because not knowing the industry allowed me to walk in and say, well, why are we doing it that way? That seems really stupid. Why isn't there a different way? And not come in with blinders on that so many people in the industry are stuck in, that they don't see the possibility. And so I feel like it has given me more, coming from not knowing this world has given me more capacity to actually find the ways to make change.
So I'm curious, what was one thing that you came in and it was being done a stupid way?
Yeah.
And you were able to help find a better way to do it?
Well, so the big example for us is actually the manufacturing work we do. What we saw with a lot of our businesses is they were artisans. They're making it themselves. They're working hard. We had a salsa company. She was in probably 200 stores. This sounds like a really strong business. She was not able to pay herself because the margins are tough in the food industry. But she was working maybe one day a week with production. Having to find staff to do that work was almost impossible for her, because who wants that job? She, as a business owner, she's not the best at managing those staff. And so there needed to be a solution to get her over the hump to the next level. Traditionally, she would go to something called a co-packer, somebody to outsource her production. But she wasn't at the right scale. So she couldn't do that.
Not enough salsa for the co-packer to want to work with her.
Exactly right. So not enough of scale, but also that co-packers like to do, they make their money by doing one thing really well. And so when you change that, when you take fresh salsa and you say, we're going to use fresh tomatoes instead of frozen tomatoes, they say, sorry, we can't do that in our line. So now this business was stuck. She just plateaued. And we said, well, does that mean our model has to stop? Because how does she ever get over that hump? And I came up with this sort of crazy, brilliant, and still very difficult idea of, well, what if we took over production for her? And could we aggregate labor? So could we take on doing manufacturing for her business on Monday and then do hummus on Tuesdays and cookies on Wednesdays and jam on Thursdays, whatever it was, and help our companies get to that next level? Let them do what they need to do, which is go sell, go work on their finances, go market, and let us handle all of the other pieces in the manufacturing. What we found was, number one, it's really hard. So there's a reason that the industry doesn't do it, and that this kind of missing link between from artisan to large scale company, there's a miss in the market and we are filling it. What we also found, though, was that, in fact, it made it easier for us to get into larger accounts for our companies. So imagine if you're talking to a buyer from Whole Foods or Stop and Shop or Harvard University Dining Services. The questions that they have are about food safety, compliance, you know, can you scale correctly? What if there's a recall? What do we do? And they could look at Commonwealth Kitchen and say, here's how we know we feel confident. So all of a sudden, what seemed like a simple thing of aggregating work turned into this place where actually it allowed us to help our company step on the gas and access markets they never would have gotten otherwise.
So the salsa company, how much salsa now?
Well, unfortunately, that business closed, but it was due to a personal issue, a health issue, so she had to close.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. But we have many other businesses. You know, we have a company, Hillside Harvest, which makes jerk sauce. They're the official hot sauce of the Red Sox. This is a company that started in our shared kitchen. He started to build his business. As he grew, he needed somebody to outsource to. We manufactured it for him. And at the same time that we do that production, we also then connected him into a bunch of buyers, a bunch of distributors. He was part of a fellowship that allowed him to actually get to the next level. So he's probably in 400 or 500 stores at this point.
What allows you as a leader to get to the next level?
I think the question is, what is that next level, right? So I feel like the work so much, it's so much relational and emotional and seeing where what we are doing is having real impact. So when being proximate with these business owners gives me such joy, but such understanding of why what we are doing matters. Because sometimes I look at it and think, really, does the world need another cookie company, right? Why am I doing this? This is of all the things I could do. And yet when I see the impact on the business owner, but also in the networks that they build, the relationships that they're building, the power of Commonwealth Kitchen is that we are building this peer group of people who in any other situation would never know each other. And here they are, two women with a business that they make sweet potato cookies from Wellesley in the same kitchen as a business that is the Jamaican business where he's got a third grade education from Jamaica and he came here. What other place in the world would these two businesses have a tight relationship where they actually help each other every day? And so the power of what we're doing, when I think about what's going on in the world right now, and how much people aren't able to talk to each other and communicate. And I think about what it means to be in a place where we actually are connected to each other, we're proximate with each other, we learn each other, we know each other, and therefore we have each other's back. Like, isn't this the way that we actually can change the world? And so for me, every day that I think, why am I doing this? I'm an imposter. I should go back to what I know. Every day I also look and say, but for me and Commonwealth Kitchen, these businesses would not get to this point.
What's the dream?
World domination, very simple.
You want to be the Khaleesi?
Yes, exactly. No, honestly, like, it is about fundamental systems change. I'm at a point in my career where I'm tired of incremental, and so I'm interested in what is the things we can do that actually cause structural change. And so an example for me of this is in September of this year, Commonwealth Kitchen took over the food court at MIT. So the Student Center Food Court, we had the opportunity to step in. We put three businesses of color, all immigrant-owned, into their own retail kiosks. All three of those businesses walked in, they started cooking, and they started selling to students. Every one of those businesses is already profitable. Like that, and it for that to have happened.
You mean from September to now they're all profitable businesses?
Correct. They're all paying themselves and profitable. That does not happen in the food industry. For that to have happened, MIT needed to change what they were doing. They had to understand that a values-aligned relationship was what was going to be required for them to have the impact that they wanted to have, and that we were able to bring them through that to show them that there was a different way. That, to me, is systems change, because MIT actually changed what they were doing. And credit to them to actually understand why that they needed to do that. Because of that project, we now have multiple other locations where we're going to be replicating.
Oh. Jen Fagel, Executive Director of Commonwealth Kitchen. What a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Tiziana, thank you. And congratulations on all the great success for the radio show.
Thank you so much. Listen, next week, our final installment of Stepping Up, we're going to be talking with former acting Boston mayor, Kim Janey. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. On behalf of the whole team, thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.